This episode is brought to you by Chevy Silverado. When it's time for you to ditch the blacktop and head off-road, do it in a truck that says no to nothing. The Chevy Silverado Trail Boss. Get the rugged capability of its Z71 suspension and 2-inch factory lift. Plus, impressive torque and towing capacity thanks to an available Duramax 3-liter turbo diesel engine. Where other trucks call it quits, you'll just be getting started. Visit Chevy.com to learn more.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Imagine a stranger wearing smart glasses, fitted with a camera and a microphone, approaches you on the street, and that interaction ends up being shared with 1.3 million people online without your consent. Coming up on Download This Show, that's exactly what happened to a woman in Sydney recently. We look at how we can stop ourselves becoming content for influencers. Speaking of being recorded, how much are our smart speakers hearing and storing? Plus, new research on a video game popular with kids equates it with gambling. And what impact does artificial intelligence being trained on images of Indigenous art and people have on Indigenous culture? All this and more coming up. This is your guide to the week in technology and culture. My name is Ray Johnston, and welcome to Download This Show on ABC Radio National. It is a new episode of Download This Show on ABC Radio National. Ray Johnston here, and it is a pleasure to welcome our guests for today. We have Fergus Halliday, who is a journalist at Reviews.org Australia. Welcome.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
And we have Lisa Sarago, CEO and co-founder of Land on Heart and Land on Heart Foundation. Welcome to Download This Show.
Thanks, Ray. Thanks for having me.
Now, there was a US content creator that filmed an interaction that he had with a woman in the street in Sydney and shared it with his 1.3 million followers without her consent. She's been trying to get it taken down. What was actually in that video that was uploaded?
So this content creator does a lot of videos where he sort of approaches women, usually on the beach or some, I think there's some videos where he goes to like university campuses and stuff like that. And he basically chats them up while wearing a set of sort of hidden cameras on his person.
Yeah. Okay. So how has the content creator responded, if at all, to this happening?
No response. If anything, his response has been to post more, which makes me think that either he doesn't care or this has happened before and it's not necessarily.
The woman being filmed asked the content creator to take the content down. Mm-hmm. There has been no response from him whatsoever. She also asked Meta and Instagram if they could do something to take the video down. What was their response?
They just left it up there, I believe. I think with social media platforms, it's very difficult when you report harassment. Very rarely do they actually do that, take the content down that I've noticed. It depends on who's assessing it as well. And so I think there's a big skills gap just in that whole, it's not just the system, it's the human beings behind the scenes that are actually making those decisions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because there did used to be a lot of human moderation that was happening on the platforms. When I say a lot of human moderation, I mean the moderation was done by human beings, and a lot of it's now been automated. And oftentimes that's a good thing for the people involved because the kind of content they're moderating is awful and horrific, and it can impact them psychologically. But then we also get left with these automated processes that might not benefit us as individuals trying to get content taken down. Yep. Now, the woman involved in this particular incident, this content being created, she reported it to the police as well. What was their response?
I believe that their response was that they were aware of the content creator, but there was not really much they could do, which is interesting to me, I think. In terms
Why
of,
so?
I believe it's the Privacy Act prohibits the recording of private conversations. And while the recording itself is happening on a beach using a fancy set of smart glasses that are cutting-edge tech, fundamentally, what we're talking about is approaching someone with a hidden camera, which is like almost as old as cameras have been around, realistically. And I think that him approaching someone and basically chatting them up, it might be happening in a public location, but is it a public conversation?
Yeah. Well, that's the legal argument here, isn't it? So it is legal in New South Wales to take photos or video of someone in public, but it's illegal to record a private conversation without their consent. Was what this content creator did legal? That is the question that we're attempting to answer here, isn't it? Because it does seem like we don't really have a whole lot of protections at all, legal or through the platforms or otherwise, to stop ourselves being turned into content for creators. Is that right?
Yeah, it's a troubling fear. I believe it's later this year, there's changes coming into the Privacy Act to try and make it easier for individuals to kind of sue over content that is posted online about them without permission.
Because you would assume that that might come under some sort of defamation or...
Only if it would be considered defamatory, right?
Yeah.
Like it definitely would depend on the situation, the content, the court, and kind of how you approach it.
Now, what do you think needs to change to be able to protect people like the woman in this story, like all of us really, from becoming content that we don't want out there?
Well, I think that in, you know, a better world, there would be laws that would prohibit this and discourage it. But in the world we kind of have, it's kind of down on the platforms, right? The reason this person goes and does this and posts this is because the incentives have made it financially lucrative for him to do it. And if Meta removed or changed those incentives, I think you would see less of this.
Mm. Yeah, I have to agree. They need to have more controls around social media. And as I said previously, even how they're actually monitoring and making the assessment around harassment, stalking, whatever it is, when people are reporting content, they need to make sure that that's being assessed by the appropriate people. Like there is a skill set involved there. It's not just any human being behind a desk can make that decision. And the onus needs to be put back on these guys who are making a lot of money. Let's be real, they're making millions and millions of dollars, and they're just allowing this to happen.
Imagine if content creators had to give a cut of their income to everyone who appears in those videos.
Yes.
I reckon they might be a bit more selective about who they approach in the street. You are listening to Download This Show on ABC Radio National. It's your guide to the week in technology and culture. And if you search for Indigenous Australian people or art in Adobe's stock image libraries, Lisa, tell me what you're likely to find.
Yeah, so I've seen some of this content and there's images that are portraying Indigenous Australians, for example, that don't look like us in terms of, and I know we come in different colours and shapes and everything, but it's very clear that they don't have Aboriginal features. The bodywork is wrong, like the body painting is wrong, so the wrong symbols, the artwork. And I know we have contemporary artists that are out there using different colours and stuff like that, but even some of the symbols that are traditional that have been used in Indigenous painting, it's not correct as well. You can literally see that it's not genuine artwork. So they've clearly gone and farmed Indigenous content using AI, created all these different pieces that aren't authentic and don't actually represent us.
So along with the AI images of people, there are also the stock images of Indigenous artworks on the side. And it really does look likely that in order to create this, there would have had to have been some theft of artwork,
yes.
Right?
Yep, correct. Like, where else would they have got the images to start with?
Yeah.
And I refer to Canva. So they have actually co-designed their artwork with Indigenous artists. Shout out to Canva because they've done an amazing job. So they work with Indigenous artists for their stock images. And so we're talking about content creators making sure that they give money back to whoever's appearing on the video. Same thing, like at least the Indigenous artists are actually getting paid, but they're also co-designing this stuff so that it's authentic and it has the permission of the Indigenous artists, and the Indigenous artists are the ones that are actually engaged to assist with that rather than just going and farming whatever's out there in the public domain and then creating their own and still making money out of it.
Yeah. So, Fergus, take us through a little bit about how image generators are trained.
Okay. Well, a lot of these AI systems are, you know, presented as really complicated, but the fundamentals, I think, are actually kind of simple, which is the idea that you can teach a computer system to learn if you give it enough examples and enough opportunities to learn. So they would set up a kind of system, a model for how a computer would think and make decisions. They would take tons and tons and tons of data samples, which are in this case are images. They would feed them into the system, and then eventually it would be able to pick up on the pattern of what is an Aboriginal image and what is not an Aboriginal image. And then when you enter a text prompt asking it to create an Aboriginal image, technology will sort of synthesize all of those data samples together.
Which is a massive problem. Yes. And where are they getting the images from generally, these image generators? I know that there's a lot of them.
There's a lot of different ones, so it really would depend on case by case. But the thing about the whole AI sector is it's very unregulated. There's not really independent verification in a lot of cases for both small startups and bigger players like Meta and NVIDIA. They're kind of just taking what they can get away with taking. Some of them use this broad banner of term publicly available data, which doesn't really mean anything in any independent sense. It's not we've gone and talked to these people and gotten permission. It's we found this and no one has called us on it. And it's easy to imagine that these are big companies with professionals and balance sheets and they're publicly listed and they would do it properly. And that's not always been the case from what we've seen.
So they're asking for forgiveness rather than permission.
Yes, very much.
So Lisa, what protections exist for artists and people to not be used to create these kinds of images?
I don't know about the people part, but in terms of artwork, the theft of Indigenous art is an ongoing issue. It's never going to go away. I grew up in far north Queensland, so I remember even going to markets and seeing all this Indigenous artwork and going, and you just knew because there wasn't a lot of artists around, like you kind of knew who was who in the zoo kind of thing. And you know, the signatures aren't there. And there were people that were copying art as well. So those artists, like that was their artwork, but it was being sold at markets to tourists and the money wasn't going back to the artists. I know Terry Jenke, shout out to her. She's done a lot of work in the cultural IP space as well. So we've got that, but I'm not sure how far that goes in terms of protecting Indigenous artists and our cultural IP.
Oh, the one thing I would just add to that is that one of the things that's really interesting historically about the internet and the ability to take stuff off it is that a lot of time that hinges on copyright law, right? Mm. When someone's trying to take down like revenge porn or something like that, it hinges on the idea that you made this image, you own the copyright to it, you have rights over it. But with AI, a lot of the early sort of court cases where it's been tested has found that AI cannot hold a copyright. It is creating an entirely unique work when it creates a synthetic piece. And then as a result, it's very difficult for the original creators to actually exert control of that because there's no laws or anything that says, oh, you have a right to decide whether your art can be used in a data set of an AI company you've never heard of.
So hopefully we have that in the future then.
Hopefully.
So is that also because it's harder to evidence that one artist's work was used to create that AI piece?
Partially, yes, in the sense that all of these AI systems are like black boxes. Like everyone understands how they work at a fundamental level, but it's very difficult to see step by step how it got from the input to the output a lot of the time. But also copyright is generally pretty respected across the world. So it's a more universal system for actually applying pressure.
Tell me, Lisa, about the assumptions that are made when these generic images that are homogenizing cultures and, you know, on this continent, we have over 250 distinct cultures that are Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander. And when AI is kind of clumping that all together and putting out this generic homogenized version of it, you know, what assumptions are made by people consuming that?
It's interesting because I think Stan Grant said it, we're not a homogenous society, right? No. And the idea that all Indigenous people all are the same. I remember explaining Aboriginal Australia to a friend that had come over from South Africa and I said to her, just imagine Europe and you plonked it in Australia. I said, that's literally Australia, but we've got way more countries. And I said, we've got our own languages, our own customs, our own practices. I've travelled out to Western New South Wales and yarned to people and like really amazed by the difference of culture that we have in Far North Queensland and Cape York compared to New South Wales. So the biggest danger is, again, the idea that we're this one society. We have very different languages. We have different practices. We do come in different shapes and sizes and colours. Yeah. So it feels sometimes that pushing us into this one viewpoint as well takes away the essence and the value that we bring as a united Aboriginal race to the world, because you're basically saying this is what you look like and we actually don't, especially in the employment space where I'm in tech doing employment stuff and continually having to explain to people the age, or you don't look Aboriginal, you know, you're not Aboriginal enough, and people's concept that the Aboriginal looks like this, that does affect Indigenous people. And I've had that said to me even leading up to October 14, oh, but you don't look it, and it's really offensive. Well, who are you to tell me how we look? We know we're Aboriginal. So that kind of then filters out to every aspect of our life and expectations that, you know, we want to talk to the real Aboriginals.
Exactly.
Or that stuff comes into play, and we're already dealing with that at the moment because that's all kind of festered and sitting there in Australia now, and people feeling they have permission to say these things to our faces. That kind of imagery and sort of playing into that field of, oh, they're just one race and this is how they look, and it's incorrect to start with, is really hard. It's just making sure that we don't go into that world again, or at least reinforcing those stereotypes that we've had to deal with.
Yeah, I think this is the kind of thing that's creating a lot more harm than people realise. You know, there's not that it's not harmful for artists or authors to have their work ripped to, you know, be homogenized in, you know, other AI forms. This is a misrepresentation of culture that there has already been systemic attempts to erase and assimilate and homogenize since colonization in this country. So for this to be happening through a tech lens as well is particularly damaging. And I think it has some really, really strong long-term impacts as well. When you've got people from across the other side of the world saying, you know, oh, what are Aboriginal people like? What is their art like? And if they're intaking AI-generated images as part of that education, it is further erasure of our culture and our individualism as people.
It adds to that as well as the one thing that I've been fighting for since joining tech is making sure that we have our voice and we have representation inside of tech. Because if we don't have Indigenous tech talent working on the design as well as the implementation of any sort of tech innovation, our voices and our culture won't be truly represented. And so, you know, the tech world misses out because they have this amazing cultures that aren't represented into tech. So that's one of the things that Leonard Hart Foundation is absolutely pushing. What we're pushing with Titters and Tech as well is all about making sure that we have representation. The biggest stumbling block is the advocacy bodies out there don't have Indigenous voices and representation. So I'll keep knocking on those doors and going, hey, and I hear about people saying, oh, but so-and-so worked with an Indigenous company once. I'm like, yeah, but that's not the same thing. Like, do you say, oh, I went to a dentist a couple of times and now I'm advocating for them at, you know, the dentistry.com or whatever it is? Like, that doesn't happen. So why are they doing this with Indigenous people?
And that's how we stop this from happening into the future, by having those voices in the room at the time to go, this is not how this works.
Yep.
And we don't want this to continue.
Yep.
You are listening to Download This Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Ray Johnston, and I'm joined by Fergus Halliday, journalist at Reviews.org Australia, and Lisa Sirago, CEO and co-founder of Land on Heart and Land on Heart Foundation. And are my devices listening to me is a question that we all ask ourselves on occasion. But Amazon announced it is removing a setting called Do Not Send Voice Recordings in its Echo smart speakers. Does this mean what it sounds like it means? What was being recorded? Where was it being sent? Fergus?
This news story made me feel so old. I think when it comes to talking about Alexa or Google Home or the HomePod, which Apple has, it's important to understand the difference between listening and recording. Generally, which is that all of these speakers have been set up and built to listen for their like active wake word, which I won't say here because I don't want to set off anyone's speakers. But, you know, you yell at your speaker, you say the magic words, it activates, and then it starts recording its instruction. It then takes that recording, encrypts it securely, sends it to the cloud server for the company. They turn that audio sample into a text command, and then they work out what the response is, and then they send that response back over the internet. And so what this setting was doing was basically allowing you to take the part where they turn the audio setting into a line of text and do that on the speaker rather than remotely. And it was sort of a long line in a lot of peace of mind features, which is where this sort of category has gone over the last couple of years, where I think there was a supposition that for a lot of people, the barrier to buying a more expensive or a new smart speaker was you go, I'm not really comfortable with this. And so there's been a lot of a push to have more privacy conscious features like this in there. And I think what's interesting about this is that it was rolled out in the US and now it's kind of being taken away rather than expanded globally. And I think that there's probably something there in terms of the broader strategy for a company like Amazon and the way it sees privacy.
So would you say that this is them looking at trying to advertise itself basically as a more secure company than it has been in the past?
I mean, I think it's more of a case of there's a big shift on the part of Amazon and a lot of these smart speakers now to go away from having a more scripted assistant experience where they've trained this assistant to do 100 things and you know exactly what you're going to get, depending on what you ask for every time, to one that relies more on these generative AI tools, where the double-edged sword of it is that you're less likely to ask it to do something and then get the very boring, oh, I don't know how to do that, and be like, oh, why don't you know how to do that? You're supposed to be smart. Like, you're not going to get that dead end as much. Instead, you're going to have it improvise answers, which is maybe technically better from like an experience perspective, but also you don't know if those answers are good. You don't know if those answers are correct. You don't know if those answers are useful. And so Amazon, I believe, is moving to launch that sort of smarter version of Alexa in sort of the months ahead. And
right. Yeah. So how can we tell if our devices are listening to us? Do we have to read all the terms and conditions? Do we have to go into all the settings? How do we know if a speaker sitting in the corner of our room or if a phone sitting in our pocket is listening to our conversations?
Sure. So like in 99.9% of situations, a lot of these devices have either visual or audio indicators to tell whether it's gone from listening for the magic words to actually recording, you know, the noise around it. Usually it will light up or it might play a chime or it might change. Like even when you bring up Siri on your iPhone, it pauses everything around it so that there's as much chance as possible for you to know that it's recording you, right? And then in addition to that, a lot of companies like Amazon have rolled out a lot more robust sort of features that give you extra control around how you're being recorded, what's happening to those recordings. A lot of people don't know that you can just go to your Amazon account or your Google account and you can just find every recording that it's ever made just there as like an audio file that you can listen to.
Wow.
You can delete it also. They give you the option to delete it, but obviously there's this trade-off of the idea that these smart speakers do get better based on the more data they have and the more experience they have listening to you and your specific verbal tics. They learn to recognize you and are more reliable in that sense. But a lot of people don't even realize that's the trade-off they're making.
That's really fascinating. I'd love to go and listen to all the recordings.
I would have just said turn it off.
Oh, yeah. To be clear, there is a 100% guaranteed way to make sure the smart speaker does not listen to you, and that is called not having it or unplugging it.
Not having a smart speaker at all.
And like there have, but again, if you want absolute peace of mind, very easy to achieve that.
Most people aren't having their smart speakers at home hacked.
Yes.
That's not really a big concern, but download this show on ABC Radio National is what you're listening to. It's your guide to the week in technology and culture. And finally, there's some new research on kids who play Roblox. And it's come to the conclusion that it is, and I quote, literally just child gambling.
As a mother of two teenage daughters who played Roblox a lot, but the thing that I wanted to make a point of was the prizes. So I've had my daughters ask me for Roblox credits and I've only bought them a little tiny bit, but I know a lot of their friends would get money all the time from their parents and I just didn't want to buy into that at all. So no, we're not doing this online gaming for money. Yeah, that was the scariest thing for me is because they're so young. I know there's new laws that under 15 in Australia you can't, but there's ways, like both my girls are under 15 and they find ways.
Yeah. Yeah, of course they do.
And, you know, you have parental control, but unless you're actually in that game with them, you don't know who else is the users. And I've asked them before, how do you know that that's a kid? How do you know that that's a kid? You know, like I'm always asking them those questions. But if they're playing games while you're in an online meeting or something, and I'm going back to COVID days as well, you don't have an ability to be able to continually jump in.
Yeah. So for those who don't have kids in their lives begging them for Robux, what is Roblox, Fergus?
Oh my gosh, Roblox makes me feel so old because obviously it's bigger than it's ever been. It's obviously more concerning in some ways than it's ever been, but it's actually as old as 2006.
Wow.
Which, yeah, ancient. And so it really is kind of about that social experience. Like I think for a lot of kids, it's about keeping up with their friends. The actual game that they're playing is maybe secondary to that. But the thing, if I were to kind of describe the kind of game it is, I would say it's kind of like RuneScape for the Minecraft generation, which is that it's kind of you enter this 3D space, you have an avatar, and then you are able to play lots of different experiences and games with your friends. Some of those games might be racing games. Some of them might be running around doing an obstacle course or solving a puzzle or doing all sorts of different things. But the thing that is different about Roblox as opposed to many other games is that it's not one company that makes all the games. It is Roblox themselves built this platform and then a lot of other entities, including some of the kids playing the game make games, and then theoretically anyone who is able to make a game can make money off that platform. It's kind of, as I said, RuneScape for the Minecraft generation, but in many ways it's kind of more similar to YouTube in a lot of ways, in the same way that you think about letting your kid loose on YouTube.
Yeah, no one really wants to let their kids loose on YouTube, yeah. Do they? So Lisa spoke about prizes that your kids are getting within Roblox. And they're known as loot boxes,
yes.
These prizes. In the context of gaming, what is a loot box exactly? How does that mechanism work?
Sure. So like in the old days, you would buy a game and then you would just own a copy of it. It was very simple. But in the sort of last few decades, a lot of companies have tried to sort of extract more money for their investment in terms of making the game because it's so expensive. And one of those microtransaction approaches has been loot boxes. And it's sort of applying the idea of like booster packs or blind boxes to video games where you have a mystery box and it may have something really good in it, or maybe have some duds stuff in it. And the reason that they are controversial, I suppose, is that they incorporate a lot of behavioral science stuff and a lot of gambling stuff in them. There's this idea of intermittent rewards, which is the idea that you can encourage certain behaviors by giving an infrequent reward. So like, even if you open the box and you don't get the thing you want, you might get it next time. Like, this is just one failure on the road to you eventually getting that thing, and that idea of like the sunk cost fallacy. And I don't think you need to have a personal relationship with the damage that gambling can kind of have on your life to realize that maybe exposing children to that is not great.
Yeah, and as a result, they have been banned in Australia.
Yes.
Like we spoke that they have been banned for under 15-year-olds, even though
yes.
they will absolutely find a way to access them.
Yes.
How are they still being found in Roblox if we're not meant
sure.
to be able to
sure.
get to them as a kid?
So I was reading about this, and it's very interesting because the mechanism is that, so the ban for under 15, so if you were to have loot boxes, your game would have to be an MA-15 or above game, which would restrict the audience of Roblox because most of their users are, I believe, under 13 years of age or something like that. And the way that they have gone about implementing it is that they have basically asked all of the game creators to put in a flag that says, oh, if you're in Australia, turn off your loot boxes for your audience, because it's not worth the risk of us being sued.
So it's on the creator side.
It's on the creators to
do
that.
Up to them.
Correct.
Oh, so they've shifted responsibility from the platform itself
yes.
and from the owners of the platform
yes.
to the individual users of the platform
yes.
to self-moderate. That's
correct.
Never going to work, is it?
And well, it's never going to work for many reasons. Like, it's not like people are going to go back to popular games they made years ago and retrofit these things in them. And the incentive for them to leave those systems in there is that they make money. Like, both Roblox and the creators make money from not enforcing these rules. And so I think it's not surprising that a lot of things are slipping through the gaps.
Perfect. Well, yeah. That is all that we have time for on the show today. Thank you, Fergus Halliday. Where can people find you?
You can find my work on reviews.org/AU, and you can find and follow me on Blue Sky at CVampedOZ, which is CVampedOZ. I also run a newsletter called Multiplier, which is all about games and technology and that kind of thing. And you can find that at multiplier.substack.com.
Lovely. And thank you, Lisa Sarago. Where can people find you?
You can find me on LinkedIn, Lisa Sarago, or Land on Heart. So it's at landonheart.com. And soon to be, on the 4th of April, we're hoping to launch our titizentech.org. So that's going to be amazing. That's a new website that we're setting up for Indigenous women and young girls who either are interested in or are participating in tech.
Love it. I'm there. And yes, you can download this show in person at the World Science Festival this Saturday. If you're listening to us prior to Saturday, you can find us there. We're doing a live recording of the program all about the intersection of technology and our brains. We have Dr. Erica Mealy and Dr. Kylie Seymour who will be joining me to answer your questions and mine all about computers in brains, brains as computers, data harvested from our brains, data being fed into our brains. Come along. You can find out more in the episode description and on the World Science Festival website. You can also find a link in my Instagram at Ray Johnston. And if you enjoy Download This Show, be sure to follow on the ABC Listen app. Leave us a review on whatever podcasting platform you use and include anything you'd like us to cover. We'd love to hear from you. I'm Ray Johnston, and thanks for listening to another episode of Download This Show on ABC Radio National.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.